welcome all. I'm going to now mute all. And people will not have the ability to unmute themselves, except Stefan, you will have to unmute yourself. You can. So we will hold all questions until either at a point if Stefan wants to take a break and take questions or until the end. I encourage people to put questions or comments into the chat window. We'll relay them from there. And we will open it up for people to be able to unmute themselves after the main presentation if you wanted to ask questions that way. So I'd like to welcome all to tonight's presentation. And tonight we have Stefan. This is going to be one of our more technical presentations that we have. Stefan is going to go into a great amount of detail about TCP/IP and how we communicate over the internet. So without stealing any more of his thunder, I will turn it over to Stefan to lead us through tonight's presentation. Stefan, sure. It's all yours.
So you should see my title slide.
Yep. Yeah, we got it.
Okay. So I'm Stefan Richard, and tonight I will give you an overview of the Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol, also known as TCP/IP, basically how the Internet works. So tonight I will cover the network topology and an history of the Internet. After that, we'll look at the TCP/IP definition and its layers. After that, we'll look at the four layers of TCP/IP one by one, so we get a better understanding all of these layers fit together. So the first layers is the physical layer. Layer two is network. Layer three, transport. Layer four, application. And at the end, I have miscellaneous network topics, mainly related to IPv6. So let's start with network topology and the history of internet. So let's start with basic network topology. So in a network, a network is basically made of nodes. And a node can be a computer, printer, server, IP camera, and a number of routing devices like a router, gateway, etc. And these nodes are connected to each other via network paths. And the network path is something, a physical or radio signal, such as like an Ethernet cable, optical fiber, Wi-Fi, satellite link. And in order to get a network, you need a whole lot of these nodes and a whole lot of these network paths. And you end up with a network topology that looks something like is shown on the screen. The nodes in green are special. So these nodes need to route data to other nodes, depending on what address you want your information to go to. And the way these nodes are doing that, it's with a routing table. Basically, the routing table tell them, the router, oh, I'm trying to reach that address. Oh, okay, I will send the data on that port. Let's say that this is your source node, and you're trying to reach this destination node. There is various path that your data packet or your information can take to reach that destination, and the routing table will determine which path will be taken. Like for example, your data can go from there, 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 and here, or it can go that way, or it can go that way. So there's various path that it can take to reach the destination. The routing table in each of these green node can be static. In other words, they are programmed once and you don't change them, or they can be dynamic, so they will adjust. So let's say that this link become damaged or it became congested. There is too much data that are going through it. It will trigger an updating of the dynamic routing table, but not only on these two nodes. Probably most of the other nodes, because maybe that node was sending to reach the destination, was sending the data that way, but now it cannot use that link anymore, so it will have to send it that way. So this can be really useful. However, if it is this link that is damaged, now that node is out of luck. It cannot talk to anyone on the network until that link is fixed. So let's talk about these green nodes. They come in various ways. Like there's various devices that can do that. There's hub, router, switch, and gateway. So we'll look briefly at what these things are. So a hub is the most basic networking device that connects multiple computers and other network devices. Unlike a network switch or router, a network hub has no routing table or intelligence on where to send the information and broadcast all the network data across each connection. So they look something like this. So this one has four ports. So if you connect your computer on that port and other things on all of these ports, as soon as you send something, it will be sent to all of these ports. So all the device would get all the traffic, which is not very good in terms of resource utilization, but it does the job. It just means that if the information is not addressed to you, you just drop that information. A router connect a network to different network, ensuring that internet traffic goes to the right network or node. And they look something like this, very similar to the hub, except that it has a port that this one is labeled as internet or to connect to a different network. Sometimes also they will pick one of the port like this one shown in green to indicate that it has a higher speed than the other port. The next one is a switch. This one connect device within a single network, transfer incoming and outgoing internet traffic between the connected device. And these ones are mainly intended for like office building when you have like hundreds of people on the floor, and the switch will have a whole lot more port to be able to handle all the various devices on a given building floor. The last one is a gateway. And this one regulate traffic between two or more dissimilar network. Mainly the one I've seen in the past were basically because of security. We're calling them secure gateway. And it looks it can be integrated in your router, or it can be a standalone device that basically has two connector and they change the protocol inside the box basically. So what is the internet? We'll look at some definitions so we have a better understanding what it is. The internet is a global system of interconnected computer networks that use the internet protocol suite, TCP/IP, to communicate between network and device. This is really important. Internet is a network of networks. So it's not a single network. It's made of all kinds of network that can be private, public, academic, business, such that your internet service provider, the Rogers and the Bell of this world, and government network of a local to global scope, like Rogers as a network that cover all of Canada, and Bell also, but other in the U.S., they have other companies that do that, so they connect all of these networks together. Linked by a broad array of electronic, wireless, and optical networking technologies. The internet carry a vast range of information, resources, and service, such as the interlinked hypertext documents of the World Wide Web, electronic mail, telephony, video streaming, file sharing, gaming data, and people will find more things also to send on over the internet. Let's look at a brief history of the internet, but before we do that, we need to look at the definition. So packet switching is the transfer of small piece of data across various network. These data chunk or packets allow for faster and more efficient data transfer. The origin of the internet date back to the development of packet switching and research commissioned by the United States Department of Defense in the 1960s, so 50 years ago, to enable time sharing of computers. The primary precursor network, the ARPANET, initially served a backbone for interconnection of regional academic and military network in the 70s with 13 nodes. The funding of the National Science Foundation network as a new backbone in the 1980s, as well as private funding for other commercial extension, led to worldwide participation in development of new networking technology and the mergers of many networks. The linking of commercial network and enterprise by the early 90s, probably everybody recalled the .com, marked the beginning of the transition to the modern internet and generated a sustained exponential growth as generations of institutional, personal, and mobile computers were connected to the network. And we'll come back to that exponential growth. So if we look at what the ARPANET in 70s and 73 looked like, in 70s, as indicated before, there were 13 nodes. If we look in 73, there were a whole lot more nodes, and it was even a connection outside of the U.S. going to London. Somebody in 2006 looked at all the various nodes on the Internet and how they were connected to get together, and they were able to draw this diagram. So basically, what you see on this, if I was going to zoom in on one of these nodes, they pick one of these green dots that I mentioned earlier, and they look at to which other node is it connected. Like this node is connected to a bunch of other nodes, and after that it goes and connected to other things. And they begin to map all of this. It's not a geographic map like the two other ones that I shown. It's just which node tau is connected to which node. And the color coding represent, for example, from where the IP address come from. Is it Asia Pacific, Europe, Middle East, Central Africa, North America, Latin America, Caribbean, or the private IP address? We'll come back to that. And unknown. If you look carefully at this beautiful diagram, you will notice some stars. And if you zoom in on one of these stars, you will notice there is a whole lot of people or connection to a single node, and there is a single data path going out of that node back to the Internet. So if that link is damaged or another problem occur on that link, a whole lot of people are going to lose connection to the Internet. They will be able to talk among each other, but they will not be able to get out. Who knows, maybe this is like a friendly country like China or something like that. Now let's talk about briefly about the Internet backbone and core router. The Internet backbone can be defined as the principal data route between large, strategically interconnected computer networks and core routers of the Internet. A core router is a router designed to operate in the Internet backbone or core. To fulfill this role, a router must be able to support multiple telecommunication interfaces of the highest speed in use in the core and able to forward IP packets at full speed on all of them. These core routers are hosted by commercial, government, academic, and other high-capacity network centers, as well as the Internet Exchange Point and Network Access Point. And the exchange internet traffic between countries, continent, and across the ocean. Your internet service provider participate in the internet backbone traffic by privately negotiated interconnection agreement, primarily governed by the principle of settled free pairing. Basically, I will connect to your network, you will move my data, and in exchange, you will connect to my network, and I will move your data for free. We don't exchange any money between the two. In addition, the high degree of redundancy of today's network link and sophisticated real-time routing protocol provide alternate path of communication for load balancing. So a link gets too much data, gets on the link, they can update the routing table to send the data on a different path and to do a congestion avoidance. But as we saw, there is still some place that is these stars that are isolated and only have one link. This is a photo of what the core router look like. It's basically a big cabinet full of electronics and networking equipment. And in the back, you need all of these various high-speed link, data link to connect to these things so they can do their job of determining where to send the data. This is an analysis that was done on the type of traffic and comparing from 2017, that's the first percentage you see on these categories, to 2022. So in 2017, gaming was about 1%. In fact, it barely show on that graph here. In 2022, it was a much bigger bar, so it has increased from 1% of this to 4% of the traffic in 2022. file sharing, even though the bar look about the same size in percentage wise, like in 2017, it was 7%, but today it's only 2%. The web data, so when you're surfing the web, as when even though it's bigger than in real number, but in percentage of all the traffic, it went down from 17 to 12. The IP video on demand, manage IP video, this one went also down. The green went down. And the internet video was 55% in 2017, and it's 71% in 2022. I don't know if you want to guess what is making that big blue bar. It's YouTube and pornographic video account for the vast majority, like 97% of that 71%. And these two share about 50% of that 71%. I think YouTube is 35% and pornographic video is 34%, something like this. And the rest accounts for the 2 or 3% making the difference. Now we're going to look at some TCP/IP definition. So first, what is TCP/IP? TCP/IP stands for the Transmission Control Protocol, Internet Protocol, and it's a suite of communication protocol used to interconnect network devices on the Internet. It gets confusing because these are the two main protocols, but the overall suite is called with the same name. So the entire IP suite, a set of rules and procedures, is commonly referred as TCP/IP. TCP and IP are the two main protocols, but there are other included in the list and in the suite. And this is not a full list. I'll just give you a couple of examples. You probably recognize some of these protocols. So the file transfer protocol FTP to move data file across the network. The sample mail transfer protocol, SMTP, post office protocol version 3, POP 3, internet message access protocol, IMAP, for email. So if you have configured your IMAP client, but you use one of these protocol, the hypertext transfer protocol, HTTP, and the hypertext transfer protocol over SSL, TSSL, TLS, HTTPS, basically the secure version of the HTTP for the World Wide Web, and many more. Before we dive into each of the layers, why are we using a layered network model? So a layered network model uses a number of layers, with each layer responsible for specific tasks. By doing so, it reduces the complexity of the problem from one large one to a number of smaller ones, each of the layers, basically. It allows for the standardization of interface among the layers. It facilitates modular engineering, so engineers can work on one layer of the network model without being concerned with what happened to another layer. As long as they don't change the interface, they can make change and they will not impact anything. This modularity also accelerates the evolution of technology and ease the teaching and learning of networks. TCP/IP has four layers. So the first one is called the physical layers, also known as the network interface layers or data link layers, consists of protocols such as Ethernet that operate only on a link, the network component that interconnect nodes in the network. So you remember these network paths, that will be the job of the layer one to do that. The network layers, also called the internet layers, transport the packet or datagram across the network using the internet protocol. We'll cover that in details later on in the presentation. The transport layer is responsible for maintaining end-to-end communication across the network. And the application layer provides application with standardized data exchange. Protocol include HTTP, HTTPS, a bunch like the one I mentioned earlier, and many more. At the application layer, the payload is the actual application data. So whatever you want to send to that destination address on the network. We'll look at how TCP/IP does its thing, basically. So it starts with a computer that has sender, if you want, that has its network software and network card. So it send, the sender will send its information to the layer 4, so basically the application layer. You will notice that I use here a double headed arrow because it will be communication back and forth. Even though it's sending something, error message may come back. So there will be information exchange between your application and the layer 4. So layer 4 will do his things and it will contact the layer 3. The layer 3 will do his things and after that it will contact the layer 2. And it will do its thing and it will contact finally the layer 1. So the layer 1 will need to connect to the layer 1 of the receiver computer, which has its own network software and cards. So in order to do that, it will go through the internet, a bunch of routers, switches and stuff like that, that will route the data to finally reach the layer 1 on your destination the receiver, if you want. And the same thing will occur, but now in reverse. The layer 1 will do its thing, and it will send them to the layer 2. Layer 2 will do its thing and send it to the layer 3, and the layer 3 will do its thing, and it will send it back to the layer 4. Finally, we'll deliver that to the receiver. And later on in the presentation, we'll look at what are the specific things that each of these layers do? So you will have a much better understanding of all that full stack of layers basically work. Now we're going to take a different view for that that process. So we have the sender with its stack of layers, so the physical, network, transport, and application. So he wants to reach a receiver that will be here. And basically, the physical layer will select a port on its device to connect to another network device or a router to send the information. So it will reach a router, and this one will go to the physical, so that these two need to have using the same physical interface, if you want. After that, it goes to the network. But you will notice that the router does not need the transport and the application. It does not need these layers because the job that is asked to do is to move these things across the network. So it does not need these two layers. And for example, the information may have come from the port number 1, and based on its routing table, it will determine, oh, I need, in order to reach that address, I need to send it on port number 4. And this will continue like this through many more routers, and we'll see toward the end of the presentation of an example of how many of these routers you can go just to reach a given site. And probably more routers, we will finally reach your receiver that will have the full stack of these layers, like the physical network, the transport, and the application. So each time you send information, you go through all of this back and forth. And the routing table in these routers will determine which port will be used for all of them. So these are the routing table. Now we're going to look at the layers. Each layer will add a header, so something at the beginning, and some of them will add something at the end, which is called a footer. So we have our TCP/IP stack. So let's start with the top, basically at the application layer. So basically, the red bar here shows the information that you want to send to a node on the network. So you will send that information to the transport layers. The first thing that the transport layer will do will be to cut this very long bar in smaller chunks. And these chunks are going to be called packets. And it will be the size of about 1,000 to 1,500 bytes. So they are not very big. So you have a very long file, there will be a whole lot of packets that are being generated. Here on this diagram, this is not drawn to scale. The header, the overhead of the header and footer is only about 5%, but I had to make that box bigger so I can type in it the description. So the transport layer basically will add its TCP or UDP header, and the data that came from the application layers will be put here. Now it will take this and it will send it to the layer below, which is the network layers. So now the IP data become the header of the previous layer and the actual data. And it will tag on a specific header for the network layers. After that, it will take all of this and send it to the next layers, which is at the link layer. And this becomes the frame data. And to that, the link layer will add a frame header and a frame footer. And this is what will be actually transmitted on the network. And when you reach a router, you only need to decode this portion here to determine where I need to send it to. And it's only when you reach the final decision that you need to go up the chain of all of these layers to reconstruct that red bar that you want to send on the network. Now we're going to look at each of the layers one by one. We'll start with the bottom one, so the physical layer. So these guys operate on a single link. This layer is all about connecting two nodes together using a media, such as copper, wire, pure silica, glass, the atmosphere, like a radio wave. And I will show you example of hardwares and what they look like, basically, but they all do the same job. They connect two nodes together. So an Ethernet cable, the wireless fidelity, also known as Wi-Fi, the fiber distributed data interface, fiber optic, microwave wireless broadband, and Elon Musk satellite internet constellation Starlink. There's many more, but I will focus on the list shown here. So the physical layer for the internet connection, it's basically a cable. It's good up to about 90 meters. They look something like this. It's four pairs of two wires. And the connector looks something like this. Like this is the back of a router. So you have four ports to connect wires into it. And this is probably the port that is used to connect to the internet or to another network. And the cable looks something like this with its connector. And you probably have one of these connectors currently making your internet connection work, basically. And you need a network card in your computer that has an Ethernet connector. This card, maybe a standalone card, or it may be something on your motherboard, but you will need one of these connectors that use basically that to use an internet wire and use the internet protocol as the physical link. Now, if we look at Wi-Fi, this one, the distance is indoor about 45 meters. If you're outside but need to go through wall, you will not go further. But if you put your router outside, you can go much like about 90 meters. So basically this one is using, the media that is being used is the atmosphere. So it's basically transmitting a radio signal between the Wi-Fi router and your workstation. They look something like this. So a small box that will have a bunch of antenna on them. And in your PC, they will have a chip. And in somewhere in there, there's a small antenna that allow for the communication of the radio signal, if you want, between this card and the Wi-Fi. You will notice that there is no physical connector. So most of the time, this is on a standalone card like this, or it can be a bunch of chips on your motherboard. Now, if we look at fiber optic, the distance you can go with these is much greater. It's about 200 kilometers. After that, you need to add repeaters. The property of a fiber optic, it's glass, and it's the type of glass that allow the light to be stay inside that glass wire if you want. So even though the wire is bent, the light will bounce inside and come out at the other end. Very similar to the other one, you need a card that has that specific interface and all the various electronic and laser to generate that light to be able to transmit and receive. And the connector with the fiber optic, if you want, will be different. So you can match with this, basically. If we look at the physical layer of a microwave wireless broadband, the distance for these is about 50 kilometers. But because of the curvature of the Earth, if you want to go to a greater distance, you need much taller antenna to reach a greater distance. They look something like this. So this is basically like an antenna for microwave, and they transmit and receive a signal between like two buildings, or if you have taller antenna, you can go much greater distance. And this is a depiction of why the curvature of the Earth become important. So if the Earth was really flat, it will not be an issue. You can always be able to reach that antenna if you want. But because of the curvature of the Earth, at one point in time, you won't be able to reach it unless you both on the transmit and receiving side, you have a taller antenna. Now let's look at the Elon Musk Starlink. So this is a constellation of satellite, and the altitude of the satellite is 550 kilometers, so fairly high in the sky. And the space segment, so basically these satellites, it's called the space segment. The current constellation is about 2,300 satellites, which is the biggest constellation on Earth. But when the full constellation is done, it should have 12,000 satellites. We'll see if it gets there or not, but anyway. So the space segment connect to a ground segment that is made of bunch of antenna, so it can transmit and receive data from these satellites. And there is many of these ground segments spread all over the planet. And these ground segments connect to the internet via other means like a landline or a fiber optic. And for you, the user, what you need is a user terminal that is basically a small antenna with the electronic to make the antenna works, and it will talk to the space segment, and this is how you get back and forth to the internet. And basically disconnect to your PC using most likely an Ethernet cable. The layer two. So this one, its job is to transport the data packet across the network. So it's called the network layer protocol. There are two main protocols, and the main protocol is IP, the Internet protocol. This is really important. This is what will make the difference between the layer two and the layer three. So IP is connectionless. It means that no state related to IP packet is maintained either on the source, intermediate, or destination node. And this is called the end-to-end principle. It will become important later on when we talk about the network address translation. IP is unreliable, which means that it's not guaranteed that IP packet will get delivered to the destination. IP will do its best. But if you encounter an error, we'll cover that. It also does not assure proper sequencing or avoidance of duplicate delivery of packets. If an IP packet encounters some errors at the destination or at some intermediate host while traveling from source to destination, the IP packet is generally discarded and an error message is sent back to the source. IP packet may not use the same network path while traveling to the source node to the destination. So this is why here we said that does not assure the proper sequencing. When they get at their destination, they may get there out of sequence, or you may get the same packet twice because an error on the link occurred and the same packet was resent, but the other one was able to get through. So you end up with the same packet twice or maybe more delivered at the destination. But IP do not care about that. His job is to try to do his best to deliver that data packet to the IP address that was identified. Speaking of IP addresses, there are organizations worldwide that help to manage the allocation of IP addresses, and there are also reserve IP addresses that can be used for specific purpose, and we'll see a few of those. The Internet Assigned Number Authority, the IANA, I don't know how to pronounce that, it's basically the international organization that they carve out the world in various regions, and you can see on the map here what are the various organizations that are responsible to allocate the IP addresses to people that want an IP address. We'll look at the header. Remember on that diagram I showed you that it was an IP header added to the IP packet. There are two versions of the IP header currently in use. There is IPv4, so IP version 6, IPv6. And this begs the question, what happened to IPv5? IPv5 was an experimental protocol developed in the 80s and was never widely deployed. Let's start with IPv4. So IPv4 use a 32-bit address, which limit the address space to about 4.3 billion addresses. You probably think that 4.3 billion addresses is a lot, but remember that exponential growth. We'll come back to that. IPv4 addresses may be represented in any notation expressing a 32-bit integer value, but the most notation you will see is the dot decimal notation, which consists of four numbers, all ranging from 0 to 255, and each of these numbers is separated by a period. So, for example, a dot decimal IP address of 192.0.2.235 represents a 32-bit decimal number 3,221,26,219, which in hexadecimal, that's another notation that is used in computer, 0xC0002EB. Hexadecimal will come back in IPv6, so basically it's a numbering system that's using a base 16. So when you're using a base 10, you have 10 symbols to depict a number, so it's 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 9. And when with these 10 digits, you can represent all the number, the decimal numbers. Hexadecimal use base 16, so they needed 16 digits, so they use a number 0, 1, 2, blah, blah, 9, but when they had to reach 10, they needed to use another symbol, so they use A, B, C, D, E, and F. So we'll come back to the hexadecimal numbers later on. So when they designed that protocol in the 80s, in the 70s, but in the 80s, they realized that the pool of available IP address, that 4.3 billion address that were available, was being depleted at a rate that was not initially anticipated. Basically, the main market force accelerated address depletion included the rapid growth number of internet users who increasingly use mobile computing devices such as a laptop computer, personal digital assistant, smartphone with IP data. I recall, like, probably 20, 30 years ago, I had one PC connected to the internet, so I was using one IP address, but today, I don't know, I probably have 18 devices in my home that need IP addresses, like PCs, IP camera, home thermostat, TVs, a bunch of my Xbox, game station. Starting in 1990s, it's starting to get real bad. And 24 September 2015, the organization responsible for the American region to assign IPv4 addresses basically said, I don't have any more. So if you needed an IPv4 address, no IP for you. You probably recognize that gentleman from a very popular TV show. So how do we solve this IP calypse, if you want, the fact that they were running out of IPv4 addresses? So there was a number of solutions, so that motivated the introduction of a bunch of things. The first one, in 1996, they introduced the private address and network address translation, NAT. And I will describe that in details. But NAT breaks the end-to-end principle, and I will show you where it breaks that, basically. And in 2012, IPv6, and we'll cover that in later slides. First thing we need to talk about is private versus public IPv4 addresses. That's the change that was done in 1996. So the private IPv4 address. It's an IP that range from, there's three groupings. So basically 10.0.0.0 to 10.255.255.255. And this will be used for a very large private network. And when I say private, what you have at your home currently is probably a private network. Or the other one is 172.16.0.0 and all the way to 172.31.255.255, which is still a fairly big number of addresses. And this one here, 192.168.0.0 to 192.168.255.255, and this will be a medium or small network. There is probably a very good likelihood this is that address range that you're currently using on your network at home currently. These are free. You don't need to pay anyone to begin to assign these network addresses, these addresses to your network device. And they are basically assigned by your network device, most likely your Wi-Fi router, to your specific device within your private network. And how do you find this address? You need to go and look at your device internal setting. There's a bunch of commands you can do on Windows that will display what is that private IP address if you want. It's a non-unique. Anybody on the planet within these address range can reuse these address as much as they want. In other private network, you cannot reuse it in your private network, but you can, in another, your neighbor, you guys probably are reusing these address over and over and over in your private network. Now, if we compare that to the public IPv4 address, is basically all the other addresses that are not included in that range. So that's a whole lot of addresses. But these ones are not free. They are assigned and controlled by your internet service provider or by one of these organizations that I listed earlier that allocate addresses, basically. You can find what that address is by Googling, what is my IP address? And this one is unique and cannot never be reused on any other device on the internet. So here's an example, all these things work together. So let's start with your router. And your router will be the one that will perform the network address translation that, and we'll see that in more details, how the router does that. So on the left side of your router, if you want, is going to be your private local network. And in that case, I pick this range of private address. On the right side, it's going to be the internet, if you want the public internet. So I'm getting my public IP address, 174.114.132.213, from Rogers, basically. And my router generated on its own a default gateway IP addresses, and also that router automatically assigned address to various workstation that I have at home, IP camera, so they all start, so it could have been any numbers between 0 and 255, and all of these basically connect. They send information to that switch. If these two PC wants to change information, the information goes here and come back here to that device. If it needs to go on the internet, it goes through that router that send it basically on the internet. Now, let's look at the network address translation. So how do we do that? Or how does the router does that? So let's start with a computer. And you will notice this is in the range of a private IP address. It's unique within that private network, but it can be reused all over the planet for their own private network. Let's say that I want to send data and to a server, and the address of the server is 200.100.0.1. So through the layers, an IP packet is going to be generated that says that the source IP is this address, so 10.0.0.1, and the place where I want to go. And that data packet is going to be sent on your private network, and it can have mini switch depending on the size of your network, and it will reach the router that will be responsible to interface with the internet, and this is the one that will perform the network address translation. So what that router is going to do is going to keep a log of that information, that the packet was coming from this address, trying to get to this address. And also you will keep track of the port, and we'll cover that in a few minutes. So you will understand why you need to keep track of all that information and where you want it to go. So basically the address and the port of the destination device. And it will keep a log of all of these things. And it will modify the packet. So the destination remained the same, but the source has been changed. Now it's showing the address, the public address of the router, 150.150.0.1. And it will just send it on the internet. The internet will do its thing with the various routers and routing table, and it will finally reach the server at this address. The server will do its thing, and it, when it's ready to send back data, it will generate a data packet that's basically, I want to send data to, it's coming from me, 200.100.0.1, and I want it to go to this address. Basically, this is the only address that he knows is this one. So remember that end-to-end principle. This is why it's being broken, because there is information about the IP packet that is maintained here. And this is the end-to-end principle. It should have been able to send it directly back to that workstation there, not doing this modification of the packet. But this resolved their problem of the exhaustion of the address space. Now people, depending on how big their private network was, they can have as many IP addresses as they wanted. And the router will look in his log to figure out, okay, I just received a packet that came from this address. So with the port numbers and stuff like that, he will be able to figure out, oh yeah, it's this address that I requested that packet. So you will modify the packet. You will keep the source the same, but the destination will be switched back to the original IP address of the server that you wanted to send it to. And this is how the communication goes back and forth. And as I mentioned earlier, breaks the end-to-end principle, because packet state information is kept on the router that did the network address translation. Now, let's talk about IPv6. Instead of using 32-bit address like IPv4, IPv6 use 128 bits. So basically 2 to the power of 128, you get a very, very, very big number. I cannot even pronounce it. So it's a big number. It's a lot of addresses. So how do we write these IP addresses? They use a specific format. The first thing they use is a grouping of 8, and each of these grouping can have an hexadecimal, a lowercase hexadecimal number, and it can range from 0 to FFFF. Basically, if you translate that FFFF hexadecimal into decimal, it's 65,535. So between these two, that range, and they are separated by columns. So if you see something that has 8 groupings separated by columns, you know that you're dealing with an IPv6 addresser. So this is an example of an IPv6 addresser. It's big because the address space is very big. That 2001 here, it's not 2001 decimal. It's 2001 hexadecimal. So this is why you have some numbers, if you want to have letters in them, it's because it's an hexadecimal number. Now, it can be tedious to write these addresses like this. So there's a number of things we can do. We can find a way to write them shorter. The first thing you can do, the first rule, you can omit a leading zero in a group. Like that zero here, you could remove that. That zero here can be removed. All of these 4 zeros can be shrunk to basically 1 zero. So if you follow that rule, you can shrink this to this basically. So it's a bit smaller, but you can do even better. It's called a zero compression. So you use a double colon. You can replace a single or a continuous string of one or more group consisting of all zeros. but that rule can only be used once. So in my address here, I have a grouping of three zeros. I can replace these three with a double column. And since I only do it once, and they know that it should be eight grouping, they can figure out, oh yeah, these ones were three zeros, four zeros, five zeros. So they bring it back to eight grouping. So basically that address here can be further shrunk to something like this. You see the double column here that represent these three zero here. We can have, if it had been four or five, it would have been the same thing. You will see sometimes, and Microsoft does that, you will see that on the, when I give you example from my workstation, they put a percent at the end of the IP addresses and they put a number or a string, and this is called the scope ID. And they look something like this. So this is the IP address with a scope ID of 3. And Windows use that a lot to determine if you want within this IP address where to send the data within the PC, which interface requested that information if you want. This is a fun fact. Each IPv6 address space correspond to a much smaller number than the previous slide, but still a big number. This is like billions of billions of addresses for every square meter. So a square meter is not that big, and you can get that many. So you probably can run your own internet in that square meter. Yeah, that's how many IPv6 addresses that there are. If we try to compare that with IPv4, you cannot get even one address per square meter. You need 725,729 square meter to get one IP address if you try to distribute them evenly. So you can see that the big difference in terms of how many IPv6 space. I think it's going to be a while before we run out. Only about 80% of the IPv6 address space, about 80% has not been allocated. So only 20% has been allocated. Now let's look at the IPv4 header. Remember when I show you that slide that had the IP packet and a header was added? So depending if you're using an IPv4 or IPv6, the header is different. So this is what they look like and the information that they have. The first thing we can see is the IPv6 is much bigger, especially the space reserved for the source and destination address, much bigger. Yeah, no surprise there because this one is 32-bit. This one is 128-bit, so it takes more space. And when they created IPv6, they kept some field the same thing, like the version is the first thing. So this is how the protocol can figure out, oh, what am I dealing with? Is it an IPv4 or an IPv6? And there's the source and destination address that have remained the same. So they kept that when they created IPv6. There's field in IPv4 that they have dropped, that they were no longer required. They have learned how to do these things differently. There's some that the name and the position where they are has changed, like the type of service, the total length, time to live. This was a setting that was telling the root, the IP, how many up if you want that packet can stay alive. And after that, if it was reaching a switch with that number zero, it was just basically dropped. And they have been replaced and renamed to other information and new field has been in. Have been covered. So this is, to go down to all of these fields gets really, really complex. Give you an idea that there's a difference between the type of packets, mainly because of the address space. Now let's talk about layer 3, the transport layers. So the job of that layer is to maintain the end-to-end communication across the network. IP, the previous layer, was just to make sure that it do its best to send the data to reach the destination. The job of that layer is to make sure that they get all the pieces in the right sequence. There are a number of protocols that can be used by that layers. So there's two major protocols. The first one is the user datagram protocol. And the next one is TCP, the transmission control protocol. UDP is a connectionless protocol that contains no reliability, flow control, or error recovery function. Because of its simplicity, UDP headers contain fewer bytes and consume less network overhead than TCP. However, it's not very friendly. Basically, the sender sends the BB or the data, and ready or not, it's coming. And this is why UDP is only used if you're on the same network, like they use for the network NFS network file system. If we compare that to TCP, TCP is a connection-oriented protocol that provides full duplex, meaning you can transmit and receive, acknowledge, so the receiver will tell you, yeah, I receive a packet 123. Flow control, we'll see how TCP does that, and service to provide all of these things to the application layer. It moves data in a stream of data packet. Sequence number identifies the packet within that stream, and TCP can also support numerous simultaneous upper layer conversations. So not only you can have one TCP communication going, but you can have a bunch. And it's basically something like this. So the sender will say, do you want to receive the data? The receiver will say, yes, I'm ready to receive the data. The sender will say, okay, I'm sending the data. The receiver will say, I have received the data. And the receiver will say, the sender will say, good, you have control of the data now. So there's a lot of back and forth handshake, if you want, between the two to ensure that the data is not lost. Another way to look at TCP versus UDP, in the case of TCP, everything is controlled. You control the flow. If you're not ready to receive the data or the water in that case, you can slow down. You just drink less. If you compare that to UDP, it's coming down. So ready or not, and most likely you may lose some of that stuff, the data or the water if you want. Now let's talk briefly about port and socket. We talk briefly about port when we talk about network address translation. So a port is a number used to uniquely identify a transaction over a network by specifying both the host and the service. They are necessary to differentiate between many different services, such as World Wide Web, HTTP, mail, FTP, and many more. So basically, they created these ports. So when you send something to an address, you need not only to say, I want to speak to that address, but I want to use that port. And the port number serves to uniquely identify that service on a particular host. And the port number used 16-bit, so it can therefore have a value from 0 to 65,535. So a lot of port can be used. In the case of the network address translation, if you don't need a port, you can use a random number. So this is how you can figure out, yeah, only you, like I'm on the 65,000, it's coming from your machine, basically. For example, HTTP by default use the port 80. So everything that is received from on your network card that has that IP address, if you want, and is tagged with that port number 80, will be sent to that port, and there is software waiting to process the data there. A socket is a combination of an IP address and a port number. Now let's look at the various headers. Remember when I showed you that diagram, there were UDP headers and TCP headers. So the first one is UDP. It's very simple. There is a source port, a destination port, the length of the data I'm planning to send, and a checksum. And that's it. If you compare that to the TCP header, this one is a whole lot more bigger. So the source port and destination port is very similar to what was before. But now you have a sequence number. Remember that now you will number the packet so they can be put back in the right sequence when they get at the other end. And not only that, there is a information in the header to acknowledge. So the receiver will be able to say, hey, I received packet 1, 2, 3, but I'm missing 4 and 5. Please resend those. And there's a bunch of other information in the header that allow for the control of the flow and like the checksum to make sure the data has been transmitted correctly. TCP slow start. So let's talk briefly about that. So you may wonder, why is my download speed not constant? Like in Windows, you can open the task manager and you can go to the performance tab and you can look at your network connection and you will see that it's not a straight line. It goes up and down. So why is it not stable? It's because of the TCP slow start algorithm. And what that algorithm does, basically, it balances the speed of a network connection. Slow start gradually increase the amount of data transmitted until it finds the network maximum carrying capacity and then reduce it, that amount of data by 50%. So if we look at what this thing does, it's basically look at a graph like this. So the scale at the bottom is the time basically, and the vertical axis is the congestion window, but basically the number of packets that you want to send. At the beginning, when you start, it's going to be a slow start, but it's going to be an exponential growth. So what TCP will ask the layer two to do, IP, will basically, first thing, will send one packet, and he will wait to make sure that he receive an acknowledgement from the sender that, yep, I received one packet. After that, he will send two. If these two are received, he will send four. So double each time. So this is how you get an exponential growth. So 8, 16, 32, 64, blah, blah, 1,024. So a packet is about 1,500 a byte, and now you're sending 1,000 bytes. So this is you get in the megabyte. And so that growth will continue exponentially until you get a packet loss. So the destination server will reply and say, ah, I didn't get that one. So automatically what will happen, TCP will drop by 50%. So it was up to, I don't know, 1,024. It tried to send 1,024. It will go back to 512. And now in the second phase, it's called the congestion avoidance phase. This one is a linear growth. And basically, it will send one packet. If this one goes through, it will send two. After that, three. So you'll see that it's a linear progression. Five until it reach again. So you get an error message saying, yeah, I didn't receive those. And it will drop by 50%. If you simulate that with many people, many nodes, if you want, that are trying to send data on a link, the result will be that the bandwidth will be almost shared equally among all the users. Because when you drop by 50%, it will allow somebody else that is trying to send data that is in the exponential growth to use that portion that you just dropped by 50%. And after that, when both reach something, they will drop by 50%, allowing for somebody else that try to get in to transmit. So over time, it's almost like that bandwidth will be shared equally among everybody that is trying to use it. In real life, that's probably not a straight line because that how much the congestion of the network, maybe there is no traffic, will be fairly high, but if there's a lot of people coming in, it will get much lower. So that graphic is probably, that representation is probably not correct. It's probably going, these numbers will be different. It will not be the same all the time. Now let's look at the application, the layer four, the application. So you provide application with standardized data exchange. So there are many protocol, HTTP, domain name system, the dynamic host configuration protocol, DHCP, and many more. I will just cover these three, but there is many, many. So HTTP should be familiar with that. It's basically the protocol that make the web works. So, and it basically it's a protocol suite, a model for distributed collaborative hypermedia information system. It's the foundation for the World Wide Web, where hyperlink documents include hyperlinks to other resources that can be easily accessed, for example, a mouse click and typing on the screen in a web browser. This was started by Tim Berners-Lee that organization in 1989. And it basically was a simple document that we're clicking and just to show the client server how the protocol could work, basically. HTTPS is the secure variant of that protocol, and more than 79% of the website are using HTTPS. So and if you recall my presentation on encryption, but HTTPS allow you to make sure that you're connecting to the right server, that's not server that won't make appear that it's a server from someone else. So let's look at an example of a transaction. So the request, does your browser will basically send a packet that contains this information. It will say, and this is described in the HTTP protocol. If you download the technical document, it will show you the kind of headers that you can use, but basically get an HTTP version 1.1. This is the name of the host I'm trying to reach, www.example.com. My browser is Mozilla 5.0, and I will accept in return. You can send me text, you can send me HTML, you can send me all of these things I can read. So depending on the browser that you're using, that list can get bigger or smaller. The kind of language you want to receive the information in, the time of encoding that you support, and a bunch of other information about the connection type that you want. So they send that packet, and the server at the other end, the web server, will receive that, and it will generate a packet that will have many packets, depending on the information, the web page you have been asked. It will say, yeah, you want HTTP 1.1, I can do that. This is the day that I'm sending back that information. The content will have some text, HTML will be used, that character set, so you can make sure that your browser will be able to display that correctly. I will send you a length of 155, but that will vary depending on what you're sending back. It will tell you when was that information was last modified. So even though I requested this in May 2005, it was the last time that web page or that section of the web page was modified was in January 2003. The server that is providing that information, Red Hat is a version of Linux, and Apache is the software, a well-known software for web page. Some kind of a tag and more information, and you will see the actual HTML tag that are being sent. These tags always work in pair. So you have this one here that basically tell the browser that starting the HTML code, and they have the same tag name, but with a slash at the beginning, basically says, yeah, that's the end of that section. Within that, there's many other headers that you can use. Tag. So the one can be used is the head. So basically that's the beginning, and that the slash tells us this is the end. And the title here and the end title, basically that will be the name of that web page that will be appear when you're on your browser that you see on the top of the tab. After that, you're going to start the body, and you have the opening of the body with the closing of the body, and the P tag with the slash P is basically a paragraph. So this will display a paragraph with the text hello world. This is a very simple HTML document. And there is many more HTML tag that you can use to build more complex web page. Like you can get tags that will link, when you click on them, will link to another page or another section within that web page, or that will display an image or play a movie. So there's a whole lot more tags that you can use. This is all basically the HTTP protocol that is running at the application layers, and after that it goes through all the other layers to get an information exchange between the two. The domain name system, DNS, you may already have heard about that. The IP protocol use numerical addresses, both IPv4 and IPv6. Both use numbers to move the packet through the internet. The domain name server map human-friendly domain names to the numerical IP address computer needs to use the internet. The analogy used is basically it's like a phone book for the internet by translating human-friendly computer host name into IP addresses. So along the stack, there will be a request sent to the domain name server to say, I'm trying to contact whatever web and web address, web domain name, and it will send back the IP address. And it will send back probably if the website has two addresses, like an IPv4 and an IPv6, it will send back both address. So, for example, the domain name www.example.com, this is a real domain name. If you type this on your browser, it will bring you to that page. It's basically a test page that people can use to test things. Translate to the IPv4 address, 93.184, blah, 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 and IPv6. So 8 grouping, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. And the leading zeros have been reduced. And all of these numbers, remember, they are not decimal numbers. They are hexadecimal numbers. DNS can be quickly and transparently updated, allowing a service location on the internet to change without affecting the end user. We continue to use the host name. So, for example, I want to go to google.ca. I will keep saying I want to go to google.ca, but who knows where with the domain name server may map this to a different IP address to balance the load on a Google server. Now let's talk about another protocol that make all of this work. It's called the Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. I recall like 30, 40 years ago when I started to work at a research center, when I got my computer, the technician had to come to my office to set up my computer with a specific IP address that he had to write on a small piece of paper. Yeah, I gave the IP address one, whatever, to Stefan. It was all done manually for the configuration. As soon as you were changing something, nothing worked, so it was a real pain. So they came out with that protocol, basically. And what that protocol does is a network management protocol used on the Internet Protocol Network for automatically assigning IP addresses and other communication parameters to device connected to the network. This is how your cable modem gets its public IP address and other parameters from your ISP and your network device. Your computer, camera, all the widgets you're connecting to your network get their private IP addresses and other parameters from your router. They use that protocol. This technology eliminates the need for individually configuring network device manually and consists of two network components, a centrally installed network DHCP server. So there's one of those running on your router, and Rogers, Bell has one running to serve their client. And a client instance, like in Windows, there is a client instance of that that is running on the protocol stack on each computer. And when you're connected to the network, and periodically thereafter, a client requests a set of parameters from the DHCP server using the DHCP protocol. And you will see an example, a very good example of that later on. I run into an issue, and you will understand all that basically solve. Like, anyway, we'll come back to that. So let's go through some miscellaneous network topics. Very long list, so I suggest we go through them one by one. So TCP/IP versus the Open System Interconnection, OSI model. So as you saw today, TCP/IP has four layers. So link, network, transport, and application. The OSI model has seven layers. So physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, and application. But you can map them to, you can do a map between those two. So the link in TCP/IP is basically the data link and physical in the OSI. The network, it's the same name, but it's not the same layer number if you want, but it does perform a similar function. Transport, the same thing. And they split the application in three layers: application, presentation, and session. So all of these things are being done here, but they have the OSI model, they have expanded in more layers again. Remember, when you're using a, why we do that is just to make, to break a bigger problem into smaller problems, so easier to solve. So how does the internet handle IPv4 and IPv6? Because currently we have both of these, if you want, headers that are being used. IPv4 and IPv6 coexistence can take three forms. The first one is called dual stack, where your network hardware run IPv4 and IPv6 simultaneously. Windows use that method. So basically, remember that stack of the various layers? He has a copy. One is running for the IPv4 protocol, and one is running for the IPv6. You can tunnel one protocol within another. This means taking IPv6 packet and encapsulating them in IPv4 packet or other way around. And encapsulating means become the new data, if you want, the payload that is being sent. Or you can do yet another network address translation, protocol translation. This is a software that translates IPv6 packet into IPv4 packet. Most of the time, unless you're in a place where there's a reason to use these two, most of the time, you, without you knowing, the dual stack is going to be used. With dual stack, your computer, router, switchers, and other device run both protocols, but IPv6 will be the preferred protocol. The downside of using IPv6 is that most legacy networking hardware server don't support IPv6. Like I have here on my home here, my smart home thermostat does not support IPv6. So I have no choice. My router run basically both IPv4 and IPv6. So first question is, does IPv6 needs network address translation? And the second question is, should I turn on both IPv4 and IPv6? So, in theory, IPv6 does not need NAT because there is so many addresses space. It doesn't need to have private and public addresses. It can give an address to everybody on the planet over and over and over. Should I turn on both IPv4 and IPv6? Yes, but it's a small, yes, it's better to have both enabled. However, you may have IPv6 connectivity to the internet, but the host you're trying to reach does not. The Windows application will figure this out using the domain name server and fall back to IPv4, but it will be a few second delay. This, if this happens often, you may want to disable IPv6 on your router, and we'll only use IPv4. As of March 2022, according to Google, the IPv6 adoption rate globally is around 34%, but in the US, it's about 46%. But still, like say, almost one router over two is still not configured to accept IPv6. Carrier networks and ISPs have been the first group to start deploying IPv6 on their network, with mobile network leading the charge. You will see later on, I will show you a couple of diagrams for these things, but there is a bunch of IPv6 addresses. There is a bunch of type for these addresses. So the first one is, what is a temporary IPv6 address? A temporary IPv6 address include a randomly generated 64-bit number. 64-bit, it's a big, big, big number, so you can do a lot of temporary addresses instead of an interface media access control. So MAC address were unique address that were, if you want, done on a communication widget like a network card or router. They were all given by the person that built that device a unique MAC address, and some routing, especially for the switchers, use the MAC address to figure out, because the IP address can change, but the MAC address in theory should not change. You can use temporary address for any interface on IPv6 node that you want to keep anonymous. And why it's anonymous is because it's temporary. It's a random number and you can regenerate it at will. So even though somebody says, oh, I got information from this address, that address will disappear. So it will not give them a whole lot of information. And it's completely normal to have multiple IPv6 address on one device. A device generated new 64-bit every once in a while and use that in the IPv6 address. Because the new addresses are generated regularly, the address are marked as temporary interface. What is a linked local IPv6? This is another type of IPv6 addresses. A linked local address are addresses that can be used to communicate with node, hosts, and routers on an attached link. Packets with these addresses are not forwarded by routers. So you remember that when I draw the network diagram, it was only there were a node, a network pack, and another node. But with IPv6, now what you can do, you can have more things on the same link that do not need switches and stuff like that. Linked local addresses are designed to be used for addressing on a single link for purposes such as automatic address configuration, neighborhood discovery, or in the absence of routers. It may also be used to communicate with other nodes on the same link. A linked local address is automatically assigned. So Windows, as soon as you turn on IPv6, it will start generating these linked local addresses. How to tell if my window computer is using IPv4 or IPv6 or both? If IPv6 is not available, Windows will use IPv4. If both IPv4 and IPv6 are available, Windows will use or IPv6 will be used first. So how can you tell which one you're running, which connectivity you have to the internet? So click on the Windows Start menu and click Search. Type ncpa.cpl and a list on the list of items found. If you do that correctly, you should get a window that looks something like this. So what this shows is on my workstation, I have four network interfaces. I have a Bluetooth connection that is not connected. I have an Ethernet connection. I have a virtual Ethernet for the virtual machine, and I have a Wi-Fi capability, but it's not connected. If I double-click on the Internet box, I get this window that pop up, and in here it says IPv4 connectivity Internet, IPv6 connectivity, no network access. So I want to get some details on that, so I can click. So obviously, right when I did that screenshot, I didn't have any IPv6 connectivity. So if you click on details, you get basically all the various IPv4 addresses that were provided under the DHCP server, but I get nothing for IPv6. This was really strange because a couple of months ago when I tested all of this, it was working fine. And I suddenly realized that I changed my router. I changed my router for Netgear RB, and by doing some checking in the setting, I discovered that the Netgear RB by default turned off the IPv6. So I surfed the net, and I went on the Roger website, and I found the specific setting that I need to put on my Netgear router to enable IPv6. And when I made that change on my router, I didn't have to reboot my PC or even reboot my router. I just, when I press save, poof, magic occur, and probably through the DHCP, the exchange, they just push, the router probably push a new set of communication parameters to my workstation, and voila, I now have IPv6 connectivity. So if I click on details, and I scroll down to the window, now I have a bunch of IPv6 addresses, like all the one I talk about, the temporary, the link local, the default, the gateway, and the domain name servers, all of these IPv6 are starting to appear. If I want to do a test now to try to figure out if I'm really using, because there's a choice here, which one I'm using, So I went to that that page here, the HTTPS speed test.infinity.com, and it did a speed test basically telling me what my download speed. But one piece of information that is really useful on that web page is telling you which protocol is being used, so IPv6. So even though both protocols are available, I'm using IPv6. But that it means that server here can probably do both, because if I go back and change the setting back on my server, my router, and this will become disabled. If I go to that page, you will tell me IPv4. Traceroute is a fun command to try. So you can open a window command prompt. In the command prompt, you can type traceRT, so traceroute, but traceRT, followed by the destination, either an IP address or a domain name, and you press enter. The command will return the hops discovered to reach a destination, and for each hop will return the IP address and the transit time in milliseconds to go from your computer to that hop. Fun story, more than 25 years ago, I was using my Ottawa Freenet account to access my work account. They were both physically located in Ottawa, but the communication was slow like hell. And I didn't understand why, like I'm in the same city, why is it so slow? So I did the traceroute command from the Ottawa Freenet to my work account, and I discovered that my data packet were traveling to Montreal, Washington, D.C., Boston, Toronto, before coming back to Ottawa. And these servers were physically located in Ottawa. So you never know where your packet are going to go to be rooted through to you reach something. Now let's do a test, and I will do a trace route from my computer to google.google.ca. So you type the command trace route google.ca. The command will reply with the name, and it talks to the domain name server, and it spit out the IP address associated with that server at that time, because the domain name server may change that address, right? And it will start calculating the hops, and a maximum of 30 hops, so you can override that by putting an option on traceroute. And in that case, he discovered that there were 10 hops, so I went through 10 routers, if you want, before I reached that server. The next three columns are the time that it took to go from my computer to that IP address. And it does it three times, so we can look at is it consistent, the speed and the time that it takes to reach that communication node. And you will see there's strange things. Like the first thing I noticed here is the first time you try to talk to my router that is in my basement, it took 189 milliseconds, and the next two were less than 1 millisecond. I suspect that why it was so long, it was because the router had to start a piece of software to be able to answer that request. So that's why I think the first one was long. This one here is also strange. I suspect, I don't know, but I suspect that this one is a core router. It's so busy that they probably turn off that protocol so that they don't answer it. So the software, the traceroute is able to figure out, yeah, I went through another op, but it didn't want to tell me how much time nor to give me the IP address. If you go to that website, the IP location, you can type this address, and it will tell you that IP is owned by Google Limited Liability Corporation and is located in Mountain View, California. So even though I went to www.google.ca, the CA didn't mean that it was really being located in Canada. In fact, I ended up on a server in the U.S. And don't be surprised if you run that command a couple of times, you may not get the same result. Maybe the first node are going to be the same, but who knows, maybe something gets congested and the routing table will get updated and you will use a different path to get there. This may change also. So after listening to this presentation, you should be able to understand the discussion between a manager and an employee. So the manager comes and asks the employee, what is your address? So the employee answer, 173.168.15.10. Now, you should be able to recognize this as a public IPv4 address. So the manager says, no, your local address. The employee answer, 127.0.0.1. Remember earlier I mentioned it was some specific IP address that can do certain things. That's an example of one. So 127.0.0.1, it's always the local host. So it's like your PC or your workstation has two addresses. There is the IP address given by the router, but there's another one, and it allows you to basically communicate to yourself to test, make sure that all the stack, the TCP/IP stack on your computer works correctly. So you could have, for example, a browser, and you can run the web server, and the address you gave is 127.0.0.1. When you send that request, it will never go on the internet. It will be sent back, and it will go to the port 80 where your web page server is running, and it will send back the page to your browser. So it allows you to test all of these things. So the manager says, I mean your physical address. He was probably hoping to get his home address, but instead he got this, 29:01:38:62:31:58. So if you look at that address, it's not an IPv4 because it's using colon instead of period. It's not also an IPv6 because I'm missing, there's only six grouping. IPv6 is 8. So it's some kind of other addresses. And this one is a media access control address, which is a unique identifier assigned to network interface controller to use on a network address, blah, blah, blah. This is, so any questions?
I'm going to unmute, or I can't force an unmute, but what I can do is I can mute everybody, including you, Stefan, so you'll have to unmute yourself again, but it allows everybody to unmute themselves, so feel free to jump in. We do have a couple of questions. So there was one early on from Alan asking if IPv6 requires lowercase on the hex codes or whether you can mix and match uppercase, lowercase. And Stefan, you'll have to unmute yourself. Sorry, the only thing I could do is mute
yes,
all.
There you go. Okay, I was clicking on the icon, but he was not doing it. Okay, so the standard says lowercase. I don't know why they pick lowercase, but.
Okay.
For hexadecimal number, it does not matter if it's lowercase ABC or small case ABCs. But in the IPv6, they decided to use always lowercase.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mark had a question. So why does my router sometimes need to release and renew its IP address?
So remember my story about when I started to work at the research center, that the technician had to come and give me my personal IP addresses and all the overhead associated with that. So when you use a DHCP service, what they do is they give you a lease of your IP address. So there is a start date and an end date. And after that, you will need to renew that. In theory, the router, if he has enough addressers, it may give you the same address that you had at the beginning, but if another request came in and you don't need it anymore, it may give it to somebody else. So, and Roger does the same thing. Like the IP address that I showed is on the slide that I had the network address translation. I'm pretty sure if I do the same thing to figure out what my IP address that I'm given by Roger today, it may be a different one. So Roger will allocate these IP addresses as they see fit. They will give a lease, and you can, if you go in the setting of the router, you can figure out when that lease will expire, and you will get a new IP address.
Yeah, we also had some questions about non-routable IP addresses, and I answered those. And basically what it comes down to is that on your DEC, which is downloadable. It's on slide 35 of your deck. It listed all of the, or most of the non-routable addresses. And there was, I think it was Harvey said there was one other one. He listed one other one that is non-routable, which is the automatic private IP addressing in the 169.254 address range. So that's there in the chat for anybody who wants it, or on slide 35 of the deck. And I put in the URL where the deck can be downloaded. Right now it's available live. If anybody else has questions, by all means, unmute yourself. While we're waiting to see if we have any other questions, either in the chat or audibly, I had to chuckle a little bit. I thought that this was a very good UDP presentation, in that it was a fire hose of information coming from you, Stefan, with no worry about whether we were receiving it or not.
There you go. You know something?
I'd like to say fantastic presentation. There's lots of kudos going into the chat right now. So a lot of people seem to have gotten a lot of good information about it. And again, we are open for additional questions or comments if you want to put them in the chat.
And this is why the presentation, I know there's a lot of words in there, but if you go back, at least you can read it and stuff like that. And if you get the actual PowerPoint, you can also get the animation, right? When I build the slide. So
yeah, we've got it just as the PDF file. So it's the complete slide is rather than the builds. If anybody really wants the PDF or PPTX file with all of the builds and so forth, get in touch with me. I've got a copy of it, and I can happily send that to you. We have a question about the backbone. Is that the network of T1 lines, or are those two things not connected? In Ottawa, T1 are we on the backbone?
T1 is just a communication link, like I think they are 1.4 megabits. Today they are at T3, or I don't know what number they are, but it's the core is just, they are, like, as I explained, it's like they selected some data nodes are going to be doing the routing amongst all the other network that are interconnected, but these, most of the traffic, a good chunk of the traffic will go through these, so they need very fast link. Much faster than T1, and they need also networking equipment that are very fast to move these packets to send them at the right address.
Would you consider that Ottawa would be on the backbone itself, or would you consider that we connect to a larger center which would be considered to be backbone, or does it matter?
For us, it's transparent. Okay, and most likely, like me, if you look at the slide, the trace route, the first three addresses in there, I typed their address in that website, and they were all owned by Rogers.
Okay.
And my traffic, I think, went to Montreal, like a bunch of other Rogers site before it went down across the border, and I suspect that the one that had stars, I'm pretty sure this was a core router somewhere in the U.S. that just sent it that way for to reach Google.
Yeah, I've run into that where you get the dropping of it in a traceroute. And my understanding of it, I may have that wrong, is that traceroute actually uses ping, and it does a ping with one hop, a ping with two hops, or a time to live of one hop and then two hops and so forth. So when you run into these, it's ones that have disabled ping. And so the packet will, you know, it'll die at that one. But then if you ping to, you know, another hop, it'll actually get past there, and then it may get reflected on the next one and so forth.
I think there is more to that than that, because yeah, I think, how do you figure out to reach the first ping, right? So there's some routing information that is sent back to tell you that
it's the time to live on it. So it says, I'm going to send out this packet, and it is only supposed to go one hop. And then the next time it sends, it says two hops. And then the next time it sends three hops. And it actually sends three packets each time, so that it's not dependent on just a single packet. That's what I've read, but I could.
That makes sense. And this will explain why probably the ping thing on my router was enabled, but may not have been running. So that's why it took a long time to answer the first ping, more compared to the other.
Ah, yes. Yeah, that could be it. We had a question is, what segment of a VPN connection uses UDP?
Don't know.
Yeah, I don't
know. I don't think that. The only place I've seen UDP used, it's when you're on the same network, on Sun Workstation, when you use a network file system, NFS, so when you're connecting your network drive, so it's the same network, UDP move a lot of data, and the chance that there is other network traffic coming in is probably low. But if you're starting to use UDP to go and connect to like Google, I'm pretty sure you will not get there. Like the packet will get all of sequence and stuff like that. So I will be, I don't know for a fact, but I will be surprised that any VPN use UDP. I'm pretty sure they use TCP.
Yeah, my understanding on that, and this goes back many years, so I'm not sure how accurate it is either, but that if you're using UDP, rather than it being at the network level, that it's doing all of the error checking and seeing that it got all the data, it's up to the application level at both ends to do any of the error checking that might be necessary.
Yeah, and the only thing they have to do that is the checksum.
Exactly. So it's a very inefficient way of making sure that you got the data right.
Right. So if I sent you, a 1 megabyte file and I said the checksum is this, did I get all of it? If it's not in the right sequence, I may have got more, less, and I put it in the sequence I received then, which may be wrong, and you run the checksum and you say, yeah, checksum is good. Should be the proper, the correct data. But if the checksum come back and say, nope, sorry, there's something wrong. Okay, what is wrong? You don't know. So. Yeah. TCP has overhead, but is alleviate all of these problems, right?
Right. I heard once that video streaming could be done over UDP because you can be tolerant of a loss of, a couple of frames of a video stream, and you just, the stuff gets sent out and they don't care if it gets received properly or not.
Right.
But
and
I don't know if that's right.
No, but that will make sense.
Yeah. Jocelyn has a question. Which is faster, IPv4 or IPv6?
I was just wondering about, because the address is longer with the IPv6, but I think wasn't for sure if it'd make any difference.
I don't think it does, because the first one is 32 bit and the other one is 128, so it's 96 bit more. If you compare the size of a packet, is 1,500. I don't think it's 1,000, so 1,500. So I don't think 96 over 1,500 is a big overhead. So I don't think it will make a difference. It's using the same. This is why when you have the stack of the layers, so the network may use an IPv6 address, but the layer, the layer one, the link layer will not care. For him, you just take all of this and become the frame data and just send it to the port that is being told to send it to.
Yeah.
Okay, I was also wondering about, because if I'm not mistaken, it would be more, the IPv6 would be more end-to-end. There was going to be less translation. Am I right? Or did I understand that correctly? Or
if you take the trace route, I think it will go through the same up. It's just that along the way, in some network, if you try to speak to somebody in China or something like that, they may not have allocated IPv6 address somewhere along that route, even though, or something, maybe the sender has an IP. The sender has an IPv6, the receiver has an IPv6, but along that path, there is a path somewhere. You remember that diagram that I showed, like that thing with like 4 billion dots on it, like with the diagram that look at brain. Along one of these paths, there's maybe one that does not support IPv6. So something, either it will just be dropped and you don't be able to communicate to that website, or you will do one of the other techniques that I mentioned, that you will encapsulate the thing as an IPv4, send it as an IPv4 on that link, and at the other end, it will be sent back on the other one.
Okay, thank you.
Jeff had a question. He said, I was asked the other day why, if Bell and Rogers could send internet service down a wire to your home, why Hydro couldn't do the same thing? I guess in a sense they could, but you'd need to have the equipment, you know.
Correct. You need a different you need a different interface at the the layer one, that link.
Yeah.
They already know because I have a smart meter, so it's sending data through the not the phone line. It's using the electrical wire that come out of my house to go and send back that information. So they just need a different, like the rest of the stack remain the same. It's only the layer one that will have, remember when I talk about the internet cable, the Wi-Fi, the Ethernet cable, the Wi-Fi, fiber optic, all of these things can just be a yet another type of interface. It will be transparent to the other layers.
Edward has a comment. He says, it's my understanding that HTTP, HTTPS is a UDP connection. Yeah, they can use it, but I think it's typically TCP, right?
Yes.
Yeah, but it is possible to do HTTP and HTTPS over UDP.
Maybe it depends on the type of information that is sent by the server.
Yeah. I mean, how much error checking do you need at the network layer rather than at the application level, where you see whether you got the data there or not?
Yeah.
Stu had a comment, I guess. Jeff had heard of people using house wiring to extend a home network, but I think there's a distance limitation. Yeah, there are networking devices that can use your home wiring. One of the biggest problems on there is that typically in the home you have a split in your home where the electrical system is actually divided in two. And so communicating across those two halves can be a real problem. So. And I think that's all of the questions. If I missed any question, by all means, jump in right now and let me know that I missed something. But in the absence of that, we continue to get kudos coming in for your talk there, Stefan. It was a great, great presentation. I thought it was fantastic, the level of information that you got across there, that anybody who had interest in what's going on in the communication between your computer and computers out there on the Internet should have a lot of insight into it now that goes beyond what they had before. So I would like to pass on my thanks to you for putting together such a wonderful presentation. As I said in the chat, there is a link to the presentation that's available now as a PDF file. It will also go up in the past presentations area over the next couple of days. You'll see that along with the audio and the contents of the chat will be posted onto our website. And so with that, I think we'll call it an end for the night. So thanks again, Stefan.
No problem.